Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd. I am founder and CEO of the City's First Podcast, and I'm very excited to have with everyone here today a panel of esteemed guests who we are going to do a deep dive on basically the topic of Vision Zero in practice. So best practices for Vision Zero in action across Europe and North America. So without further ado, I would just like to thank our sponsor, PTV Group, Econolite, and Imovity, in terms of providing the support as well as the thought leadership around this topic of Vision Zero, a timely subject that influences the very nature of how our cities kind of function, circulate, and operate, and helping us plan ahead for future design practices in the coming decades as well beyond. So with that, I'd like to just kind of introduce our guest briefly and just jump right into our topic here. So first, we have Michael Kent, who is the policy director with the City of Chicago, Illinois Department of Transportation. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
And then next, we also have Hagen Schuler, who is a transport consultant with PTV Transport Consult in Germany. Welcome, Hagen.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. And thanks for having me.
And then last but not least, we have Sunny Chakravarti, who is head of engineering with Econolite based in Southern California, U.S. Welcome, Sunny.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Great. Okay. So with that, we'll just jump right in. Kind of our normal format is kind of a series of about four or five different topics, kind of a roundtable. We'll have an organic discussion talking about different themes and then basically kind of introducing these concepts to the audience. And we'll, of course, field any questions that others may have, and then we'll just kind of uncover the results in terms of taking to a context, let's say, of how Vision Zero is being put into practice. So with that, I think around this topic of Vision Zero in action, gentlemen, what I'd really like to focus is on kind of this overview of localism and neighborhood level initiatives. So the first topic I'd like to kind of pose to you all, but I'll start with Michael here, is kind of how Vision Zero is being impacted at the local neighborhood level. So perhaps maybe Michael, you could provide an example of a Vision Zero initiative that you are either responsible for or that you are exposed to within Chicago DOT at the neighborhood level, perhaps in the west side or the south side, that is very interesting we could kind of share with our audience.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks, Scott. So I'll first provide just a bit of context on where Chicago's Vision Zero program came from, but then get right into those specifics that you had asked for, Scott. So Chicago began pursuing Vision Zero about a decade ago when we identified a handful, about 10 different what we call community areas across the city of Chicago, where rates of traffic violence, so serious injuries and fatalities, were greater than other parts in the city. That's not to say that there's any part of Chicago where traffic safety isn't a priority, because it is a priority in every corner of the city. But we did identify about 10 different community areas where we saw more traffic violence happening. We call these high crash areas. For each of these high crash areas, we then pursued local plans working with elected officials, community organizations, other stakeholders, youth, schools, you name it, to really get into the specifics, the motivations of how people choose to get around their community, how they choose to get around their neighborhood, how they would choose to if they felt streets were safer than they are. So one of the things I like to emphasize with Vision Zero is that it's not just about understanding streets per se. It really is about understanding people and the decisions that people make. And that's why the data side is obviously important. It's important to know when crashes are happening, where they're happening, why they're happening, et cetera. But you really have to get down to the community level and speak with individuals about how they're making their decisions. So that community planning process led to a number of projects. I'll highlight just a couple. Our Vision Zero Southside program looked at the community areas of Washington Park and Grand Boulevard, which basically encompasses the Bronzeville neighborhood that a lot of folks may be familiar with. That planning process took a couple of years, where again, we reached out to a number of folks in the community to understand what their priorities were. One street that kept coming up over and over and over again is Indiana Avenue. It's a major north-south street, largely residential, going through those neighborhoods. It had been three lanes of one-way traffic. In other words, very, very fast moving, not comfortable for a lot of people to cross on foot. Certainly didn't want to cross it on bike. And so that led to our department being able to lead a project to really calm traffic on Indiana Avenue. And that took place this past year, where we reduced the number of travel lanes, we added curb extensions, bus bulbs to make it easier to get to and from the bus, and protected bike lanes. This is a project that we're very proud of, that it's hopefully going to both make Indiana Avenue a lot safer, but also inspire similar projects elsewhere. A quick other one that I want to mention is the Belmont Cragin community on the northwest side. That was part of our Vision Zero Northwest Side planning process. That project involved a lot of ongoing engagement with youth, community organizations, schools, et cetera, to identify key routes for our neighborhood bike network program. That's been implemented over the course of several years, developing greenways, several greenways in the Belmont Cragin neighborhood, again, working with local stakeholders to identify how they can be as successful as can be. And just this past year, we did a number of projects along a street called Long Avenue, where we had sadly seen some very serious fatal crashes in recent years, and worked to make that street, which runs through parks and schools, residential areas, a lot safer. I could go on and on with other projects. I think that gives a good glimpse, though, of some of the work that we're doing and continuing to do here in Chicago.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah, and it seems like there's a recurring theme around these, let's say, quasi arterials running through residential districts that pose a direct challenge in terms of perhaps being low to middle density, but providing a real, let's say, collision point, figuratively speaking, in terms of perceived quality of life and what could actually be improved for the near and the middle term. Certainly related to a one-way street that's three or four lanes of direction of travel. I think that that's inherently interesting as an opportunity to help, let's say, calm the traffic landscape and to provide more of a neighborhood amenity that provides for all types of, users active and whatnot. So I think that's really encouraging to hear, especially on the Indiana Avenue example. So let's maybe jump over to Sunny. So Sunny, maybe we could talk about one or two examples that you're focused on in my stomping grounds of Southern California, either LA or Orange County, with a local municipality that Econolite's working with, and some interesting, let's say, findings from a case study perspective.
Sure, Scott. Thank you for the question, and thank you for having me again today. So Econolite is headquartered in Anaheim, California, sort of in the middle of sunny Southern California here. It's a city best known as the home of Disneyland. I think that that's how people know it. And although you asked me for one example, maybe I would like to mention a couple of Vision Zero programs or safety-related programs in our vicinity. Econolite may or may not be involved in all of this, but it doesn't really matter in this particular context. It is important that good work is going on for Vision Zero and for making roads safer for everybody. The first one that I want to mention is for the city of Santa Ana, which is in Orange County. And Scott, I'm sure you know of it. It's a not going into the particulars of the demographics of the city itself. I can say that this particular project came through a plan that they came up with called the Santa Ana Vision Zero Plan, SAVZ. They identified Euclid Street, that is an arterial that runs through Santa Ana and certain other cities in that area. And they came up with a metric called the highest killed or serious injured per mile. I know it sounds awful to hear, you know, of such a metric, but that's what they came up with. That's basically kind of similar to the HIN, the highest injury networks sort of concept that we have when it comes to safety and Vision Zero. So they calculated the KSI per mile, and out of the 10 projects that they identified based on this, this particular one in on the Euclid Street came up on the top. The city is proposing that the Euclid Street Vision Zero Improvements Project, as they call it, it'll implement ped, bike, pedestrian, bicycle, and motor traffic safety measures along a 1.5-mile segment of that particular street. It's a high-speed arterial, like I said before, and it does not have, you know, infrastructure like high-visibility crosswalks or bike lanes and so forth. And as a result, they have had 95 vehicular collisions and 16 pedestrian bicyclist collisions during the years 2018 to 2023. And that has resulted in 182 injuries in all modes. So that was sort of the vision behind this. The project has started. It hasn't completed yet, but I can talk to some of the things that they have in mind as part of this project. They want to install buffered class two bike lanes with green conflict area striping. That's, you know, one of the things that they want to do there. They want to construct directional ADA compliant head ramps at four intersections in that 1.5 mile segment. They want to reduce curbs radii to force the drivers to slow down as they approach the intersection in order to safely turn. They want to install a specific turn signal, and they want to install a new traffic signal at an intersection that did not have a signal at that point. They also want to reduce vehicular lane widths, as Michael was talking about before, to encourage reduced travel speeds. And that's one of the typical ways to do traffic calming, as we know it. And finally, they also wanted to do some curb extensions and striping and come up with some high visibility marked pedestrian crosswalks. So these are some of the things that they have in mind. The total project cost for them is $15.2 million. And like I said, the project has just started. So we look forward very ardently to the completion of this project and the good things that it will bring to the community there. That's a community that's largely dependent on, you know, taking transit. It's not, you know, there are certain parts that are not that vehicle centric. And it's basically serving all kinds of people from all walks of life and trying to make road travel in any mode safe for them. The second one that I would quickly mention is SANDAG, and that is the San Diego Association of Governments, a little south of where we are, but it's still, you know, pretty much in Southern California. They had a similar program, but much bigger than the city of Santa Ana. I wouldn't go through the numbers and so forth, but they spent a long amount of time to understand the crashes. They did crash profiling. They figured out the hotspots in a heat map and so forth. And that's how they're trying to funnel their money and the funding that they have in those areas. And they have very, very similar kinds of goals that I talked about before: traffic calming, making you know, constructional changes to certain parts of their county to make it safer for everyone. The final project that I would like to mention is with Caltrans District 12 in the Irvine area, and that's probably close to where you used to live, Scott, so it's probably going to be pretty close to home. There are 52 intersections that are part of this project, and Econolite is very, very closely associated with that. We have provided our traffic controller, so it has the Cobalt controllers from us running EOS as the controller software system, and we have provided Autoscope Vision cameras to provide advanced detection of vehicles and pedestrians and bicycles. And this is a project that started, I believe, in 2024. And it's going on very strong. The initial results are very good. They've had some project reports and so forth. And we expect that to hopefully expand beyond the 52 intersections as well, obviously depending on funding and so forth, and make that entire area much more motorable and drivable and pliable for all kinds of users, including the vulnerable road users, the VRUs, as we call them. So those are the kinds of examples that I have from our vicinity here. Back to you, Scott.
That's great. Yeah, a lot of these things hit close to home. I've worked actually myself with Caltrans District 12 many times. I used to work in Irvine and Irvine Spectrum. I lived in Dana Point, so I'm a South Orange County resident for many years. But the Euclid Street project is really important. I'll fixate on that first example just to kind of separate the chaff from the wheat here, only because I think that's interesting. Santa Ana is the most historic municipality in Orange County. Its history goes as far back almost as Los Angeles. It was one of the polar settlements in the Los Angeles basin and has a very rich urban history built on kind of a dense street.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Network of which Euclid Street is part of off the Interstate 5 freeway south of Disneyland. And I think that basically the city of Santa Ana is getting back to basics, getting back to its pre-automobile era kind of pedestrian-centric approach to urbanism, only because really the street grid and the built environments lend itself to these traffic calming Vision Zero measures that are basically changing curb radii, changing, let's say, street calming measures, as well as reducing lane widths that only make for a dynamic that promotes more active mobility amongst cyclists, pedestrians, et cetera. And of course, boosts public transit for the many residents of Santa Ana that use OCTA, Orange County Transportation Authority, the bus, OCTA bus. So I think that this is a wonderful opportunity for residents of Santa Ana to really kind of find their place as a semi-dense urban core and a place of commercial activity, and using the infrastructure and assets that are really part of that framework and trying to plan for the future. So very happy to hear about that project. And I've been following that one, Sunny, so thank you for sharing. So with that, Hagen, I would love to hear from your perspective as an expert transport consultant with PTB Transport Consult, maybe a similar example of a use case or a project that you're working on, perhaps with a small to mid-sized German municipality, whether it's in Bavaria, whether it's near Stuttgart or near Frankfurt, somewhere nearby where I believe you might be based in Karlsruhe, but I'm not sure. Correct me if I'm wrong. But something that you have been engaged at the municipal level with the German municipality public sector that we can share with our audience.
Yes, Scott. I'm based in Stuttgart here, so we're mainly working with the local projects for municipalities.
I was Stuttgart, yeah. So that's why I mentioned it.
Yeah, in southern Germany. Yeah, okay. So I can't really pick one safety project that covers like everything. So it's all bits and pieces where we bring the safety aspects in, and it's the bigger cities like Stuttgart and Munich, but it's also like the smaller cities like Reutling or Essling here in the greater area of Stuttgart, and they kind of have to do with similar things. And I picked three topics I would like to bring in as an impulse.
Sure.
One is what we did, and which is always important, that what the people perceive as risky and as a big safety problem isn't always the problem that we have with crashes and so on. So we have to kind of level this together. And what we did there, we asked people, it's in a small residential area of Munich, what they think are the most risky spaces and what are the most risks. And then we put this on a map, and then we compared it to the crashes that we found from police and put it together, and therefore kind of wanted to bring the people to think and to listen to us also, that we get into a better, more constructive discussions. What we could change in the residential area, and what are the risks that we need to cover, because they sometimes feel unsafe, but sometimes this is even the point where are the most safe places, because they're really, you know, they look, they drive slowly because they're kind of unsafe, but then it becomes safe because there are no crashes there and the other way around. So it's always about talking with the stakeholders and the people that live there to really give them the whole picture. This is one important thing. Another important thing that we have to cover a lot is leading bicycles through the cities. This is a big topic because we have our main crash statistics, a big part of it are bicycle crashes. And right now, in the last 10 years, we're really pushing bicycle traffic in the cities. And what we have at first is more bicycle crashes. So it's really hard to make those cycling lanes, bicycle lanes, bicycle boulevards, and so on, to make them safe and to find enough space to make safe guidance for them. This is a main topic for us. We have like limited road spaces in Germany in lots of cities. We have demands from parking vehicles, from pedestrians, crossing pedestrians, the bicyclists, and so on, and we can't really give everybody what they need. So we have always find a balance. How can we get the safest planning or design with the limited space? And this is a real big topic that brings us together with the people and the stakeholders. And just to give an example, like bicycle boulevards is a big thing right now, which lead to sometimes residential areas where bicyclists have priority. But we have a big thing with the parking vehicles at the side of the road. And there's a lot of talking about bringing in like buffers, the safety spaces between the opening doors and the bicyclists. So they're not driving right to the parking vehicles, but in the middle of the road. So they are not hit by open doors. And so it gets more safer. So this is a big one. And another big one is parking vehicles altogether. Freeing intersections of parking vehicles is a topic that is in Stuttgart really important to ensure sight distances and visual contact between the conflicting parties. And it's the problem here is more that the people who live there need the want the parking spaces, although they're bad for the road safety there. And this discussion there is kind of hard to even take away one single parking space. And here you need different approaches. Some municipalities try to set a different narrative. They don't say, we don't take away parking lots, but we improve your city, we make it safer, we make it more livable. Some even municipalities change parking lots to the city or street furniture, where you can sit on the road and make it more livable. So you bring in something new that the people, they see something positive, because what they not usually do, if you take away a parking lot, they don't see the first thing that comes in mind, improves my safety. The first thing that comes to their minds, oh, there's a missing parking lot and have to search longer for a free parking space. So you have to kind of get a positive thing in there. So three things, like subjective versus objective safety, perceived versus real safety, then leading cyclists to the city in a safe way, and dealing with parking vehicles, because they're often an important risk factor to road safety.
Well, it's certainly in Stuttgart. I'm familiar. I've been there several times. You know, there's a generational, cultural, and a chronological shift occurring in Southwest Germany right now. Even more unique, specifically than Berlin or Hamburg. Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there is a tendency to be a bit controversial here. There's a car culture in Stuttgart and in Bavaria and southern Germany, similar to where I hail from, Southern California. And similar to maybe parts of even Southern Europe. So there are regional and cultural factors that influence the perception of interventions related to Vision Zero, related to active mobility, related to urban design transformations that, let's say, reconfigure public spaces for new purposes and use cases. And the cost benefit of these changes have to be carefully considered when being presented to the public. Given these kind of cultural, historical, generational factors, are we talking about boomers? Are we talking about Gen X? Are we talking about Gen Z? Gen Z and millennials, they like to bike more. They like to take public transport more. Of course, in Europe, even more so than the US, but there's a generational factor. Whereas a lot of, let's say, boomers, Americans or Europeans, Germans, would be a bit more, let's say, beholden on their automobile. And that's part of their kind of cultural DNA. That's part of their normal way of interacting in urban environments. So having said that, let's say if we focus on a city like Stuttgart, which in its public space, I haven't been there since 2019, I'm sure it's improved massively, but in the city center, it was still quite friendly for automobiles. We'll just leave it at that, 6 years ago. So I believe the urban landscape has softened and become a bit more cycle friendly. But even compared to other municipalities, I believe that this transformation is an opportunity, as you mentioned, Hagen, to present perhaps the carrot versus the stick. The carrot meaning what is the trade-off? What is the substitution? If you take away, subtract a parking space or two, what economic or physical infrastructure benefit would a citizen or a tourist, let's say, achieve from this policy decision? This is a policy decision that's impacting a change in investment in new active infrastructure. So having said, I'll pause for a moment, or if you want to reflect on that, I think that it's a very mixed bag, as we Americans say. It's not a clear path. And in terms of the engagement with stakeholders, I'm going off on a tangent here only because I think in this example, there's a lot of selling involved. There's a lot of selling involved to the public, to the administration and others, in terms of, you know, let's say breaking down these institutional and cultural barriers, these silos of thinking, and moving towards planning for the 21st, you know, century post-COVID city is what we're talking about here.
Yeah. I would say the policies there. I mean, it's there from the federal state of Baden-Württemberg, and it's
the
there
sum.
Even
you
from the
sum,
city.
Yeah, the sums are there, of course.
From the city
those
municipality, but it's taking time. You know, I mean, you have like those restricted road spaces. You have different demands, and it's getting more and more. Now we have the demand that we have to bring our cities to be climate resilient. You know, then we need more shadings and all this kind of stuff. It's getting more and more demands, and to balance those different demands. This is the challenge. And so, and then it takes time. So I would say, I mean, the car culture is still here, but I think the city administration is really progressive. But it takes time to really, to you know, that the people get involved with it, that people feel, oh, it's changing something, that they accept it, that they can live with fewer parking spaces, you know. And so it's not, it takes years. It takes tens of years, probably. But we are on the path, I would say, to that.
I've been amazed by how fast it's actually happened. I realize it takes years, but I think even since the pandemic, some of the changes, and we'll get on to the next topic, Michael and Sunny, just give us a moment here. But I think at least here in Europe, the changes in the built environment in the city centers have been transformative in terms of the pedestrianization, that's a long word, pedestrianization of our public spaces, whether you call it a CBD, a downtown, a high street, whether you're using the UK term, the European term, the North American term, the city center. The city centers are transforming rapidly. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about Sofia, Bulgaria, Vilnius, Lithuania, or Lisbon, Portugal. They're all on the same path because those public policies And Michael, I'd love you to weigh in on this, the perspective of the city of Chicago. These public policies are in place. These plans are in place. And we're seeing some rapid deployment of capital investment in reconfiguring these spaces above and beyond what we saw in these open streets experiments, let's say mid-2020, which were a bit of just this kind of pop-up infrastructure that we all saw in many American cities and here in Europe. These are becoming permanent. And we're only 5 years on in this. So I don't mean to disagree with you, Hagen, but and I realize, and I was a civil servant for many years working for government, but just in this last 5 years, it's been pretty breakneck, at least on this side of the Atlantic, of what we're seeing at the city level. But maybe, Michael, if you want to weigh in on this.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. And actually, one thing that you guys have both said is very similar to a point that I wanted to make as well, which is that cities today look very different from the way they looked when I was growing up, the way they looked even just 5, 10 years ago. I think that's an important point to be made in terms of the sort of the urban design impacts of Vision Zero and the Safe Streets movement broadly, is that our cities do look different. They do feel different. They're not all the way there. We're still sadly see too many crashes, too many serious and fatal crashes, but we're getting there and our streets do look different. A point that I wanted to make is that we're thinking quite a bit in Chicago and presumably other cities as well about the relationship between land use and streets. So what's happening off of our streets and what's happening on them, and how do they influence each other? The way that sort of manifests, at least one way it manifests in our work, is collaborating with our partners in the planning department here in Chicago. Whenever there is a development project, a major development project that requires significant city review, to contemplate not just what ought that building look like, but how would that building, the way it's proposed to be designed, impact our streets. One example, the location of curb cuts or driveways for parking garages. Yes, our big buildings still oftentimes do have parking garages. How do we work with our planning department?
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
And with developers, really, to ensure that the design of the building and really the location of driveways and curb cuts are done in such a way as to minimize the risk for potential impact with pedestrian traffic, people in general. So I think that's something that we're really focusing on quite a great deal more. And just taking a step back now, a little more broadly, I think we can say that the Vision Zero movement has really led to a sort of a reset in the priorities of a lot of transportation departments citywide to, yes, there's still a focus, of course, on getting through your city efficiently, reliably, with some degree of predictability. But I think it's really reset some of the priorities to really focus on things that are tangential, but no less important to transportation. So public health benefits, are the people of our city physically, mentally, emotionally, psychologically healthy? And what is the role for transportation to play in all of that? Natural environment, thinking about emissions and how do we get more people walking and bicycling? There was a point that Hagen made a few minutes ago that, again, I hate to disagree, but I think I know Hagen had mentioned sort of the distinction between people's perception versus the quote reality of cities. And I think one thing the Vision Zero has helped us understand is that perception influences reality. Perception isn't reality, but it certainly influences it. And so that when an individual or when a community understands a street to be a dangerous place for them potentially to be, whether it's traffic's moving too fast or there isn't reliable infrastructure for them to use the street as they would wish, perception influences the decisions that people make ultimately. And I think that's something that we're really working hard to grasp, is how do we influence people's perceptions of the street, and how do people's perceptions of the street influence what we in government are able to build alongside our partners in the community.
I don't know. Oh, Hagen, I don't know if you had something to say.
Yeah, I would like to direct that. I think we're on the same path, which is for me important when I talk about perceived safety. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we want to change it so the people use the safe, the safe infrastructure. I mean, yeah. take the thing with the opening doors. I want to make it for them to feel safer in the middle of the road, so they're not driving with their cycles next to the parking vehicles. You know, so that's what I'm talking about. And also that we can't only let our decisions led by the perceived safety, because it could be then we choose infrastructure designs which are actually not safe. There's a big topic that's really controversial in Germany, is zebra crossings. We found out in research that they're actually not really safe, which is different aspects. But the people, when they want to find a safe way to school for their children, they demand it. They all want the zebra crossing, but it's not the safest one. So, and this is really complicated topic to get out of there. And the street administration or the city administrations, they know that often, but they get all the people or say, look, we want more of these zebra crossings. And this to lead this discussion is really, complicated. So what I want to do, they should feel safe, and it should be safe, and not the other way around.
Yeah, just to kind of pull this together. So the psychological aspect is clearly, important, the perceived and kind of the, let's say, how the image influences reality. I mean, Jane Jacobs spoke about that herself in The Death and Life of American Cities, in terms of, kind of eyes on the street, and, perceived safety equals measured impacts and improvements in kind of, let's say, multi-use, multi-purpose, zones and nodes of activity that can promote more healthy outcomes. And one area, Michael, that I'd like to add to what you said, to be a little bit more, maybe more pragmatic and business-minded, is the economic development benefits as well, too, to this whole aspect of Vision Zero, and kind of this shift in modalities towards active, let's say, urbanism. Whether it be emphasized in more a pedestrian or cycling activity, and transforming retail and commercial activities to, let's say, extract benefits related to, tax revenue, footfall, et cetera, making that case for Vision Zero and these traffic calming measures that can have a measured community and economic development net positive gains. So that's another area too. Sunny, so I'm really curious to hear your perspective on this same topic, kind of related to what Michael had mentioned, the interface between Vision Zero vis-a-vis, let's say, street design and land use, and what you've seen in your practice in Econolite in Southern California or in some other region.
Sure. We have touched upon a number of things already as part of our discussions, and some of the usual measures making the width of the driving lanes lower, so narrowing those and all of that, those are better. Making sure that in the high engineer networks, especially, we have speed limits that don't cross a certain limit, those are important. And when I talk about speed limits, sometimes it's said that between, let's say, 35, 45 miles an hour, which is 55 to maybe 70 kilometers per hour, That's also considered quite dangerous. But us, you know, for those of us that live in areas like Southern California, it's very common to have 35 to 45 miles per hour speed limits, or even 50 or 50 to 55 miles per hour speed limits, which goes up to 80 kilometers per hour. And the majority of traffic fatalities occur when those kinds of things happen. You know, there are cities in the U.S. and elsewhere. So, for example, I remember, I think it was Madison, Wisconsin, that had this thing called 20 is Plenty. They had this campaign that they would, in most of their city, have 20 miles per hour as the highest speed. To be honest, you know, myself included, most people, when they have to get down to 20 miles per hour and they're used to driving at 45 or 50, it doesn't give someone a good feeling as a driver. There's a social aspect of this as well to Indeed. Get used yeah. to it. You know, because someone grows up, you know, driving in those kinds of speeds, and you know, when you force them into being at 25 or 20, they're not, and they make mistakes as well because they're probably getting frustrated, they're getting antsy about getting to the destination and so forth. So there's that part of, you know, urban design as well, where not just decreasing speed limits and so forth, but working with people, somehow educating and influencing them to be more patient with those lower speed limits and so forth. I do remember reading an article in Harvard Public Health some time back, and unfortunately, I think that publication is not alive anymore. I think they had to stop; they didn't have funding or something like that. But the article was titled "When You Design Roads, That Is Public Health." It was very telling to me. I'd never heard about it being, you know, expressed just like that. That's true. You know, when you design roads, you're talking about public health and, you know, the overall safety and well-being of your citizens. Should I go ahead, Scott? The recording stopped.
Yes, continue. Yes, okay. Continue.
All right, thank you. So that actually, you know, brings to home, you know, what you need to do and what we are after. One of the other things that I wanted to mention in terms of urban design, and you know, things have been said, bicycles have been talked about, pedestrians have been talked about as well. There are some new modes of mobility that we are seeing, e-bikes and e-scooters, that I think are complicating some of the things that have traditionally worked for us and have added some additional variables into the mix. That's honestly making things more challenging for us. And I'm sure this is not just a US phenomenon, it's in Europe and probably parts of Asia as well. But especially around you know, touristy zones or near schools, we see a whole bunch of e-bikes, for example. And these are somewhere between your traditional bicycles and cars, because they can go up to 25, sometimes 30 miles an hour, which is, you know, pretty fast. But they're also pretty less protected. They don't have the cushioning that a typical car has, and they can knock down people and other things as well. So how do we protect them? You know, there are some educational programs that we do, but that, as I said, I think adds another layer of complication or complexity to how we design cities as urban planners and so forth. As we work with our the cities around us, the counties around us, things like these keep getting talked about, and you know, these are probably top of the conversation and discussion lists at this point in time. And they were not there 5 years ago, or probably even pre-COVID. So that's a new challenge that we have to deal with now.
20 is Enough is an interesting program. I'm a huge proponent of that. I was aware of that program in Madison, Wisconsin, albeit several of us who were born and raised in the Sun Belt in cities with arterials with stroads, where 20 would be unthinkable, right? If you're from Arizona, California, Texas, forget about it. Madison, Wisconsin, right up the road from Michael, you can speak about this, has some unique geographic benefits that would be amenable to 20. It sits on an isthmus between two large lakes. So I think 20 is a bit more, possible in that type of environment. It has a very dense street network in that isthmus kind of land bridge. So I'm not saying that 20 miles per hour isn't doable in many American cities, but geography and context matter. And I think that it's important to understand that maybe it's also a good approach to maybe, let's say, phase in or blend these types of policies over time, so that you don't jump from maybe 45, 50 miles an hour down to 20 just in a short period of time, you sort of want to kind of, let's say, introduce these policy changes over time so the public can understand, you know, the benefits involved. It can't be just a clear break because, as we had mentioned before, there's historical, there's cultural, there's geographic context, and perhaps what works in Madison is not going to work in Dallas or LA, and what works in, you know, in Copenhagen is not going to work in Kansas City. So we really have to be clear about the cities and environments that we're working on. Let's kind of move on to our next topic, which is around data and technology. So let's say, Hagen, maybe if you can provide your perspective in terms of how we can leverage data and technology for Better Vision Zero programs based upon your practice in transport consulting.
Yeah, for us, data is, data-driven decisions is the main key that we have as consultants. The thing with the road safety is that crashes are like, there are multiple influences, so you need multiple data, link it together to get the full picture. And there is a lot of data out there, but often it's in poor quality or it's not, you know, processed and that it fits our perspective as people that work with road safety. So here the important thing is we need to process the data better. We make it more available, which is kind of the thing here in Germany. We have really good crash data from the police, really extensive data, but it's not always easy to get to this data and work with this data. And people are not used to work with this data and interpret it, read it in the right way. So this is a big topic that we have, but we're getting better there. What helps us there is the European Union, because it puts some pressure on us to make more proactive, assessments of our road networks, and that forces us to improve our data. And right now we're doing it's not urban, it's on the big autobahns, but still it changes something that the European Union says you need to assess this, you bring data together, use more risk proactive assessment methods, and this really changes something, improves, and road safety practice will profit from that. So for us, it's bringing data together, link it and make it available, and especially make it process it in a way that we can work with it from the road safety perspective. That's my main key points.
Great. Thank you, Hagen. So, Michael, what is your perspective from Chicago DOT?
Obviously, data is integral to a lot of what we do. Obviously, you know, I'd mentioned that speaking with community members is important, but yes, data-driven solutions are key to what we do. I'll give just a couple examples. The first is a program we instituted a few years back that's continuing to grow. It's our left turn traffic calming program. And so with the crash data that our department receives in review.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
What we found was that at certain intersections in the city, a disproportionately high number of crashes involving pedestrians were specifically with left-turning vehicles. So we were able to, across the vast city of Chicago, start to hone in on which intersections, again, are experiencing a high volume of left-turn crashes, and work to implement improvements at those intersections that would make the left turning traffic safer. So what those improvements are is essentially a hardened center line to reduce the amount of time and space in which a pedestrian is exposed to the possibility of a crossing vehicle. So reducing the risk for a crash. And what we've seen happen across many of these project locations is that left turning crashes are in fact down, that pedestrians are in fact safer crossing where these installations have gone in. And that's all a reflection of the data analysis that our team, again, is doing to not just look at the when and the where, but why are crashes happening? What kinds of crashes are happening? And so, again, it's getting back to that no one solution fits all sort of circumstance. You have to really look at the granular level to see what is the right project at each location in the city. One other thing that our department is using is mile vision cameras. So we have a couple hundred cameras set up all around the city, which is providing just invaluable amounts of data and information about traffic volumes, about traffic speeds, about mode shift at particular locations. So we can track that across time to really see sort of seasonality in our traffic data and also how things shift across different parts of the city over time.
Thank you, Michael. So sure. Sunny, what is your perspective on kind of the use of data in infusing Vision Zero programs?
Yes, Scott, I work in engineering and product management. So data and engineering and these things are things that we work with every day. So we work on, in Econolite, building products that provide as powerful features in traffic controllers and detection systems as possible in the hands of the DOTs and agencies that makes life easier for them. And they can do things that we talked about before for traffic calming and some of the other design aspects. And, things like traffic signal optimization as well, quite easily without having to go through hoops and write lots of logic statements and things like that. There are inbuilt support for a lot of things in our products and so forth. I would like to mention a particular research report that I came to know about, I think about a year ago. It's an NCHRP research report, and the number is 969. It is from 2022. It's called Traffic Signal Control Strategies for Pedestrians and Bicyclists. And that I thought was a very, very well-written report and had chapters in terms of providing an overview of what the issues are. The fact that we have had traditional focus on prioritizing vehicle movements, and then there are sort of geometric limitations, infrastructure related limitations, things like that. And it also points to research, for example, that delays more than 30 seconds for pedestrians potentially lead to increased frustration, risky behaviors, non-compliance, and so forth. And how to handle things at a signal optimization, signal timing change level. And they have a number of very detailed chapters with guidance in there. Just to talk about a couple of things there, and I'll come to the data part as well along with it, is the idea is to reduce the conflicts or eliminate conflicts as much as possible. Michael talked about protecting the left turns. It's possible to have protected only left turns, for example, at intersections, and similarly protected only right turns or no turn on red and things like that. That's the difference that I see when I drive in Europe. Typically at intersection, you would not be able to make a free right turn in Germany. But in the US, that is something that is common and is used and allowed at most intersections. So that's something that can be done. And there's this obvious trade-off between safety and efficiency. On the one hand, you want to be more efficient, have more motorists be able to go as quickly as possible, and probably true for pedestrians and bicyclists as well. But as you try and put these barriers in trying to make it safe, you're probably also making them slightly inefficient. And that's that trade-off that I'm talking about. But in order to reduce conflicts like I was talking about, you can think about exclusive pedestrian and bicycle phases, sort of channelized right turns. There are things called islands. Leading pedestrian intervals are big, you know, where you have the pedestrians go first before you open up vehicular traffic at the intersection. There's also ways to reduce pedestrian and bike delays. For example, a shorter cycle length, potentially resurfacing some of those peds and bikes, ped clearance settings that can serve better the slower pedestrians, you know, maybe pedestrians that are elderly or, you know, on a wheelchair or something like that, or probably even, you know, children that are walking slowly or something like that. So those are good ways to handle that. The other part, and this is the document that I spoke about refers to as well, is to provide added information and convenience, pedestrian countdowns, bicycle countdowns. They're very helpful. You know, accessible signals. We didn't talk much about accessibility in this session today, but accessibility is a big one as well, I'm sure, for Michael and Hagen as well. So, you know, can we have push buttons that don't need the push button actuation? I think right around COVID times, we started thinking about or talking about touchless considerations for push buttons. I didn't see them being advanced too much, but I think there were a few vendors that came out with those, but they're not that popular anymore. But, you know, doing that even for accessible reasons, I think, is great as we design our cities. Coming to the data, we have tons of data. I think Michael was talking about it. There's no dearth of data at this point in time. And most of this data is actionable data. I personally feel that we can do more in terms of taking action on the data that we already have. There is one part of the data that can be post-processed, again, as Michael was talking about, to understand hotspots, understand trends, behaviors, time of day changes, you know, weekday changes and all of that, seasonality of traffic and all of those. There's the other aspect where if we can do something proactively or even reactively right there and then, you know, let's say, you know, there's a potential near miss that we detect from all the detection equipment that we have out there. Can we quickly make a change? Let's say there are 2 seconds left in my pedestrian signal, and there's I see that there is someone that is in the middle of the pedestrian crosswalk. Can I do something? Can I make quick changes to the way the lights are, either extend the pedestrian signal timing or maybe hold the intersection in all red for another 5 seconds or something so that person can safely get to wherever they are going at that point in time? So dynamic changes, if we can do based on the technology that we have access to, I think is great. There are some DOTs and agencies that are doing it actively, and I think more and more folks are going to keep doing that going forward. Talking about data, you know, things like pedestrian, bicycle, conflicting vehicle counts, average ped delays, average bike delays, operating speed. One thing that we didn't talk about was the dilemma zone, and I think, you know, we probably don't have too much time to go into the details of that, but that's something that we see is a very tough problem to solve. There's no right or wrong, but there are known ways to gather data, put advance detection for understanding if someone is entering the dilemma zone and at what speed and acceleration, all of that, and make suitable mitigation measures to decrease the number of the possibility of collisions and things like that. Those are important. So again, tons of data and tons of great traffic and transportation engineers that understand and know how to deal with these things. And I expect to see these things more and more as we get more VRUs really on our streets.
I like how you mentioned as well, too, that, well, not to put Michael in the spot, but to the public sector and the public sector really taking a different view towards the use of data and the use of these types of applications that can benefit, you know, a range of, let's say, environments related to kind of a multi-purpose, multi-use, multimodal environment. I think that that's this kind of generational and institutional shift that we're seeing with a lot of city as well as state DOTs across the US right now. And it's very encouraging to see, let's say, division by division and just department by department, a new embrace towards how these different measures can all be, let's say, connected towards sounder public policy. So with that, let's maybe start looking at wrapping this up here with some final thoughts, maybe a minute or two from each of you guys to give us your view. What's the kind of forecast for the future of Vision Zero? And what are you excited about that's on the horizon that maybe perhaps you're working on? So starting with you, Michael.
Sure. I think the sort of the forecast for Vision Zero is really that the case doesn't need to be made necessarily to a lot of folks as to why Vision Zero is important or why traffic safety is important. Sure, we're going to still keep advocating for traffic safety, but I think we've moved from an era of advocating for it to an era of implementing it. So how do we increase our effectiveness in working with community members to accept that traffic safety is the goal, period. Traffic safety is the goal. But what are the solutions that make sense at the sort of granular community level? Again, taking into consideration the data, the perceptions, everything that we know about how our cities can and should operate, really, again, moving toward implementing a suite of projects that are coming out of our transportation departments. So whether it's a resurfacing project or an engineering project, really integrating it department-wide.
Excellent. Thank you. Hagen, what are your final thoughts on kind of the forecast in the future for Vision Zero the next 5 years?
For me, the main point is, and I want to take this up from Michael, is we need to implement it. I mean, we know a lot, but we have to bring it out and implement it, I mean, all over the city. And I think the key there is, as I understand Vision Zero, it's shared responsibility. So it's not only the public sector. I mean, it's also there's all the departments in the public sector, but it's also the companies and so on. I mean, big topic, I think, which becomes more important is corporate mobility management and thinking more about safety. Where this case is a big company who need to realize that more and more people that came on the bicycle to work were calling in sick because they had an injury. And I said, oh, we need to do something about it. And that's a good thing that it's not only the responsibility of the public administrations and the companies can also do something. So this shared responsibility thing is really important for me. And then finding little tools to implement safety in the mines. And I have a really good example here from Baden-Württemberg, where the municipalities get financial support from the state and federal governments. And they started to link these financial supports to safety audits. And so they forced even small towns to do safety audits. And this made a big change because it didn't do it by themselves, but now they needed to do it, and they more were thinking about discussing safety aspects. So now their planning is getting better and better. And this is like a small step, which made a big change. And I think and it will play out in the future more and more because people were discussing and more thinking about safety. And now they're using it in the planning. And though we maybe in the future need less audits where we look at the plans because the planners do that themselves. So this is for me a really good example where we hope this will be more of this stuff in the future.
So a more pragmatic approach, kind of a hands-on approach, getting people to lean in and really take responsibility and do by practice, which manifests in terms of the implementing that you and Michael have been talking about, which is great. So yeah, we've conceived it, we've sold it enough, we've painted the vision of Vision Zero. Now we just need to get the work done. So Sunny, what are your final thoughts on this?
Scott, before I go to my final thoughts, there's something that I wanted to mention. I should have mentioned that when I was talking about data and technology. The whole connected vehicle thing, I think, is important as well. And it's not just connected vehicles, but connected vehicles, connected pedestrians, connected bicycles. And with data flowing, we can probably make things better and safer. Obviously, without making it, you know, any more unsafe when someone is looking at their cell phone and not paying attention to their surroundings and things like that. You know, one of the things that we talked about in Econolite and now going into sort of my concluding remarks is metrics that matter. So we have tons of data like we talked about, metrics that matter. We would take a look at those and make our plans and, you know, take action. And I think both Michael and Hagen talked about doing things. That's very important. It's certainly doable. You know, I did read that Helsinki, for example, a mid-sized capital city, not as big as a London or a Rome or, you know, one of those, but they succeeded to have a year of zero traffic deaths. Hoboken, New Jersey had 8 years without a traffic debt. So it's doable, you know, and obviously it needs purpose. It needs persistence and being deliberate in what, you know, someone is doing. It's important. I like what Hagen said about the shared responsibility. It's the DOTs, the agencies, the people that are doing it, and folks like us that build products and so forth. We are all in this together. It's a complex problem that needs to be addressed a little bit at a time. Campaigns, education, all of those things are very important. But at the end of the day, we need to be persistent and deliberate in our efforts, and I'm sure we'll succeed over time.
I think Oslo might be on that list too of zero traffic deaths. I think that was a year or two ago. So yeah, if Helsinki, Hoboken, and Oslo can do it, the rest of us can, right? That's the takeaway here.
Yes.
So gentlemen, I really want to thank you for your time. Michael, Hagen, and Sunny, it's been enlightening. It's been a real refreshing conversation, speaking about Chicago, speaking about Germany, speaking about Southern California, real concrete, real world examples, understanding how this translates to public policy and practices in the built environment, urban design, and how cities and the private sector and other actors can make a real change in a short period of time, in less than 5 years. So we're seeing these results already starting to bear fruit, and it's very encouraging of what's on the horizon the next 5 years to come. So with that, I wanna thank you all both. I also wanna thank our sponsors, of course, PTV, Econolite, and Umovity for sponsoring this episode. We're very excited to share this theme with you all on Vision Zero in practice. Once again, we appreciate all your insights today, and hopefully we can have you all on for a future episode of Cities First. We will return with our next episode after the New Year. So thank you, gentlemen.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.